swan song edition for the 2010 season of Digesting Politics.
Withdrawal is coming, right, Kevin?
Yep.
And sleep is coming after election night.
I wanted to say that I'm Andrea Bernstein.
Thanks. I'm Ozzy Paber. That means anything you knew, I knew it first.
I'm Bob Henley.
I'm Brian Lehrer. So now that we've hidden our identity, what do we think?
DiNapoli pulls it out. To me, that's the headline.
Really?
Whoa.
Well, no, actually, when, it isn't the headline, but we were talking about how vulnerable he was last week. So.
When was the comptroller's race ever a headline? That's kind of amazing.
Right now.
You know,
really?
Next,
I think we should change direction.
Okay. Right? I mean, isn't that kind of extraordinary given the political climate in the country and even in New York?
If that's
that DiNapoli won?
If that's your headline, what's your headline?
My headline is, this is a 52-45 country. The big sweep that everybody's talking about for the Republicans, they got 52% of all votes for House of Representatives nationwide. 52% to 45% going for the Republicans. I guess the other couple of percent went to the rent is too damn high party or something like that. 45% to the Democrats. In the 2006 midterm elections, we remember that was the big historic sweep when the Democrats took control again after, 12 years or whatever of Republican rule in Congress. That was 52% for the Democrats, 45% for the Republicans.
Well, that's 7%.
That's
right?
All it is
so,
American politics.
Because that's a 14% swing,
even,
right? Am I doing my math right?
But if you look at the percentage of people, eligible people that are citizens to vote, it's even smaller. It is such a – and this is what I thought looking at what happened, how Paladino kind of ambushed Lazio with 250,000 people out of a party of 3 million. Something happens when the level of participation drops down so much that just a handful of committed individuals have more than an amplified vote and can really hijack a party.
And I've got the stat. The eligible voters or of eligible voters – 42% voted on Tuesday.
Now, I like to use the other number, which is eligible adults who are 18 but don't register because they're worried that they might get called for jury duty. And actually,
I think we should ask as a bonus question, you know, what is the square root of 2 to the 10th while we're at it?
Well, right, because the 42%, I think these are the same stat in all seriousness, because it's not 42% of registered voters. It's 42% of eligible voters, people who could register then vote.
So that's pretty anemic. I mean, that's when you think about it. And then also
– but the highest it ever gets was 2008, which was in the 60s. I mean, it never gets to be like it is in some other Western democracies and other democracies in the 90s.
Right.
I mean,
like Australia.
You know, right? 60% or 60 plus some odd percent was historic.
Well, and the level of disengagement, I think, has something to do with the inability then to marshal the country or wherever you were elected to run because you already have such a fractured base to begin with. It's very hard to get a sense of social engagement. And when you've got tough choices to make, it's even harder because the number of people that are really present in your camp is a fraction of the people who you're asking to make sacrifices.
It's like that healthcare stat. 48% of the people who voted told the exit pollsters they want the healthcare reform bill to be repealed. 47% said they want it either retained or strengthened.
Yeah, I don't know, Brian. I'm not as impressed with that as you are.
Why not?
Because more people than not want the healthcare bill repealed. I mean, this was supposed to be something that was going to be embraced by the American people. That is what the Obama administration's talking point was at the time, which is as soon as it sinks in, it will start to be popular.
But
Once it's passed, it will start to be popular.
And not to predict that it will be popular because I think it's
In 2014, it may be, if it lasts that long.
Right. It's an extremely complicated bill, and we don't know what's going to be popular and unpopular in it as time goes on. But a similar thing happened in 1966. After Medicare was enacted in 65, there was a huge backlash. And
really? Half more than people than not wanted to repeal it?
I believe that can't say I was paying attention to politics in 1966, but this is something that I read this week. And I don't remember the stat, but some huge, and I think it was a majority of Americans at that time, but don't quote me, wanted it to be repealed.
So they had buyer's remorse, in essence.
Now that's the reason they don't like health care, because it's cutting Medicare.
But I mean, what's happening, though, we have to look at the effect of how the practical reality for Americans and small business and business of any size, any enterprise, even government, the healthcare companies are jacking up the rates before this thing kicks
in a major way.
And that was foreseeable.
Right.
That's not a
right.
surprise.
And then they're telling people, we are doing this because of healthcare reform, which to me is not a failure of the Obama administration to explain what the bill is about. It's a structural flaw in the way it's implemented in terms of garnering popular support. Because, I mean, if you look, for example, I mean, we do have a laboratory in Massachusetts. Thank you, Mitt Romney. Who's already, I'm getting like already a zillion press releases from. I think 2012 started about, you know, yesterday afternoon at 1. Hmm. But we do have a laboratory in Massachusetts where they have many of these provisions. They have a mandate, and it's popular. I mean, once you get everything in, it's more liked than not. And that is, I think, one of the sort of key problems for the Obama administration is that there's this big sense of uncertainty because so much of what's going to happen with healthcare hasn't happened yet.
And my point was just as a matter of journalism that when we report or talk about healthcare and the American public's reaction to it in this election today, never mind what the talking points of Obama are, what people may think in 2014, that today it is not a consensus of Americans are against the health care bill. It is Americans are divided down the middle by the health care bill, and as many people support it as oppose it.
Was that reflected, do you think, in the reporting?
No, I don't think so. Right. What do you think?
You know,
I thought it made it sound like this is an overwhelmingly unpopular bill. This is, you know, what the American people asked for is for them to repeal the bill, and the American people are split down the middle.
You know, I think one of the problems is that people like me – like I spend all my election season among the 14% of voters that can go either way.
You go to swing districts.
It's all swing districts. And I don't know what the crosstab is for those swing districts, but you know, my guess
is
that they didn't like it, or were fearful, or were just afraid. I mean, there's so much, you know, in people's lives and on the airwaves that is making people so scared that. You know, this sense of uncertainty, I think, is so I think that that's the problem, is that people like me go spend all our time talking to independent voters and people who might go either way. And, you know, that is – it's 14% of the 42%, and yet it's sort of all of the, you know, political laser beam, you know.
Well, because that's the ballast, how they come out determines what happens.
Right.
I think that – The big problem here, and the president kind of owned this yesterday at his White House press conference, but there's something – they made a calculation back in October before the election, the presidential election, that it was a good thing for President Obama as Senator Obama to be seen with George Bush and Mr. Paulson, the captains of the universe who are going to save the banking system. Now, what happened for a lot of Americans is the clock started running on Obama then. Because he spent political capital to buttress up this arrangement. Now we're seeing that there's all kinds of big frauds that are involved. I mean, this thing that's going on with Bank America and these mortgage mills is turning out to be a huge fraud. If I had robo-signatures basement of my house, I would go to jail.
And financial regulation, there was a financial regulation bill that passed this year, right?
Right.
But what do people know? They know the banks, despite financial regulation, think that they can make things up. And take away their homes.
And the irony of this is that what happened, what got them into trouble was when they created, the Washington Post did the best reporting on this thing called MRS, which was this huge factory where they could bring in tens of thousands of mortgages and trade them and move them. They didn't bother doing things like enter the lien at a county seat or mortgage at a county seat because property is someplace, one place. And as long as the value kept going up with the mortgages, it was no problem. But once they had to dial up the same county seat and have county sheriffs who are paid by local county tax dollars go and execute the paper, then they had a problem.
Right.
But the Republicans ran on the Democrats. I'm glad, Bob. The Democrats ran on the overregulation of the banks, right? This is... Did they?
Well, they were going to make it safe. Well, there were certain things that they were going to. That was one of the Obama things.
The Republican.
Party start when Rick Santelli did his rant on CNBC against foreclosure relief?
Right. Let the process move forward.
Let the banks take all those houses.
But also those same people.
I heard the Obama administration say that too. It's very confusing.
Also, the same people, though, a lot of the Tea Party people I've spoken to want to audit the Federal Reserve. There was a feeling that the government all of a sudden was involved in huge chunks. And the president owned this yesterday, saying, yeah, you know, if I'm watching the auto industry and I'm watching the banking industry and the healthcare industry all of a sudden have a major influx of government money and regulation, I might feel it's gone too far. But these were emergency times. The problem is he didn't make the case for the emergency.
Ozzy, I got a question for you.
Uh-oh.
Republicans gained, what, five seats? Five seats in New York?
Yes.
Is that right? Five seats?
Five. Now it's seven altogether.
To me, what does this tell you about five House and am I counting right? Five House seats?
Yes. Which brings their total up to seven, I believe.
So I just am fascinated that, you know, that's pretty good showing. That they were able to do well in those congressional races, and they lost all the statewide races.
Right, but you have to remember the bar was so low to begin with. They had lost seats in the Obama wave and leading up to that. The fact that they had lost, you know, the Hudson Valley seat to John Hall previously with a Sue Kelly candidacy, which included her running away from, you know, TV reporters in the waning days of the campaign, a la some of the Tea Party candidates we've seen around the nation. The seats that they had regained were seats that had traditionally been Republican for a very long time. So the fact that they were one back, it's sort of like, you know, when there's like a low tide and you could sort of see where the water used to be. Well, now that the water has risen back up to that tide, do you call it a flood or do you call it just getting back to normal?
Yeah, I mean, it's still fascinating to me that they, you know, couldn't win it. I mean, in 1994, Republicans won the Attorney General of New York, and they won the governorship of New York. And part of that was this, you know, big Republican tide. And
that was the same year that Gingrich took Congress.
Alphonse D'Amato became chair of the Senate Banking Committee that, you know, that night, effectively. I mean, so this was like a lot of power for New York Republicans.
But this is also an upstate, downstate thing, right? I mean, with the exception of Michael McMahon losing to Graham on Staten Island, which is, you know, geographically, it's the deep south of New York City.
There's Brooklyn in the mix. Come on.
A little bit of Brooklyn in that district. But that had been a Republican seat forever and ever.
Right. Until
Vito Fasella's scandal. So that, you know, that's the one seat downstate.
You know, you can't
Everything
run with
else,
two families in New York. That's the problem.
Well, Andrew Cuomo does multiple families the old-fashioned way, sequentially.
There you go.
Carl Palladino had an issue with families that came to the forefront.
Exactly. He had two families.
Which did not
just
stop
like Vito
him.
Fasella.
Hey, were you so surprised?
Simultaneously.
I was so surprised to see that the first place that Andrew Cuomo appeared was Fred Dicker. Well, didn't that surprise you?
Here we go.
No, I'm just saying. I just was so predictable.
What was their headline yesterday? The sun also rises? Brian, you were going to make a point about Staten Island. I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. No, the point is really about upstate and downstate and that they're two different universes and that we just have so many voters in New York City. Is it 40% of all the voters in New York State are in New York City?
It's a big chunk.
And then if you take some nearby suburbs as, you know, roughly similar politically, but upstate, all these counties that Palladino, while getting swamped in the total statewide vote, carried by large margins.
Well, and that's what
Who ever heard of Wyoming County?
But oh, he I've won heard of it. Wyoming County.
He
I
won
did.
It with 68%
of the vote. But can you name something in Wyoming County other than the fact that it went this way or that way in an election? Is there anything iconic there?
Wyoming County's in the southern tier, right?
What do I know?
Hey, I want to say, though, Brian, to your point, that's why the Bonus state question. Senate was undecided. We had talked about this on our air before the election, that Palladino would have the effect of ginning up turnout in these House races upstate and give the Republicans a fighting shot in the Senate. To that degree, it may have succeeded.
I know where Wyoming County is. It's sort of between the southern tier, which is, you know, the sort of Binghamton, Ithaca, the area that borders Pennsylvania to Pennsylvania to the south. It's between that and Rochester, Buffalo. It's kind of right in the middle of there. Not much there.
You lost
They
me.
Got a lot of stimulus money.
Cuyahoga County, Cattaraugus County, Niagara, Erie, Chautauqua.
Wait. Oh, well, Palladino won Erie.
Yeah.
But still,
Chautauqua
that's fascinating.
Chautauqua County, which is not Chappaqua.
Oh, I'm
Palladino
sorry. I missed this factoid. Palladino won Erie County?
I believe he won.
I mean, Erie County always goes Democrat.
He lost
Democrat.
Buffalo.
Well, I want because it was
he lost Buffalo City
because that Senate seat went
because
for the Democrats.
Because that's a city.
It's the biggest concentration of Democratic voters.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong about Erie. Yeah. That's possible.
You could be right.
But the
Can
point
check,
is
Richard?
That things are
He won
Erie, we're told.
Wow.
Things are very different upstate, and things are economically
paying more attention to that.
Desperate upstate.
Well, we were talking about that.
And Cuomo will be.
We were talking about that at our news meeting. Right, didn't we talk about that at our news meeting? We talked about that at our news meeting.
Are you going to tell people what we spoke about at our news meeting?
Restoring the empire.
Because this can be very embarrassing very soon, I think.
Why?
No, I'm just kidding.
No. Just we want to have this project to get some stakes in the ground to look around the state at the economic conditions before Cuomo takes the stage to get a sense of where it's really at and look at the diversity issues, the issues of economic revitalization. Because you know what? Both the Republicans and the Democrats have tried to turn around the economy historically, and they haven't done a good job.
Well, like the half-cooked idea that I had like during this edit meeting was we've seen three terms of one Cuomo already. We've seen three terms of a George Pataki. We've seen one term of Spitzer-Patterson, you know, fiasco. And all of them seem to have said roughly the same things. We're going to create more jobs. We're going to fix upstate. We're going to make sure New York City is livable, blah, 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 all that stuff. And before we see the next Cuomo administration start, I thought it'd be interesting if we could put, you know, as Bob said, our stake in the ground or a finger on the pulse, whatever metaphor you want to say, and pick an area and say, this is what it's like right now. Anything from cost of milk to, you know, this particular family and what it's like at their dinner table, and sort of measure it as the years goes on. Because inevitably, 4 years from now, we're going to be sitting at this table or whatever shape of digesting politics will take.
This amoeba-shaped table.
Right.
And we're going to hear information from Cuomo saying how awful New York was when he came in and how great it is now that he's been there for some time. And I just thought it would be a great idea to start measuring in an objective way early on. Where are we right now and where are we going to be? Because
I hope for those residents upstate, you know, I wish him luck and I hope it is. Because, I mean, there's a lot of desperation in upstate New
York. It shows an infant mortality rate. I could not believe that a third of New York State's counties have an infant mortality rate higher than the national, and they're going in the wrong direction. Some of them have had a double increase in infant mortality in just a year. And these are the places also where you see the population bleeding out. And that's a huge challenge.
Right, but it's not just, you know, that's true of the Bronx, too. I mean, the Bronx within the five boroughs has high infant mortality and poorest congressional
But the city is much better. I must say, the city, it's stunning. The city's performance on this is better dramatically than upstate.
On what?
The Health and Hospital Corporation and the general level of care for women and children in the city is better than some of these upstate poor counties.
You know, can government really affect the structural economic decline of upstate New York?
That's what we wanted to find out. Exactly right.
That's a great question. There was a panel discussion at the New School, and Liz Krueger, state senator from the West Side, had said at one point that we shouldn't be spending money on economic development on the state level because a lot of what happens, a lot of things that impact the state economy are usually national or international in scope. Trade agreements, businesses that decide to pick up stakes and move elsewhere because of federal regulations. And she seemed to acknowledge that there's a limited role or a limited power that a state government can have in creating these jobs. And Andrew Cuomo, when he was campaigning, seemed to address that in some form, saying he's going to create these business councils that'll help with a geographical approach to creating jobs, knowing that there's some constraints on what you can realistically do. And Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, I think, kind of says this. He tries to make New York City a destination where people want to live. Mm-hmm. And if your employees want to be here, employers will come
also.
Well,
that's where education comes in.
I have a hard time
accepting.
I mean, Buffalo, you know, was a city that 100 years ago people really believed in. And, you know, I mean, look at Buffalo, look at Toronto. I mean, Toronto is a relatively successful city. There they are, sort of same latitude, kind of, you know, not that far apart. I mean, I don't believe that there's any reason why Buffalo has to perennially not work. Now, I don't know what the best idea is, but I mean, certainly, you know, there are places across the country that are picking up with things like green energy projects, and a lot of these old steel mills are, you know, getting converted to wind turbine. And, you know, I think we should
really— Pittsburgh, not that far from Buffalo, seems to be a positive example of being able to bring in, you know, a new tech economy. Well, after the old steel economy collapsed?
Well, one of the things
that works nice.
One of the things you have to do, I think, is we're in a period of time where the Obama administration did what it could to try to turn this around. What really has to happen is a new kind of very localized self-sufficiency and sustainability model at the granular level, where people in a community just decide that they're going to turn it around, and government should try to facilitate that. But when you see empty buildings and you see empty lots, then it's really up to the people in a place to authentically connect and identify how to turn it around. I don't think it can happen from Washington or it can happen from Albany.
Might be able to happen from the private sector, though. And I think that that's something – I mean, I think that the next 2 years are going to be interesting, because I think that, you know, whatever – narrow margins of people were saying, you know, do this, do that. I am quite certain that the overriding message to Washington is don't spend a lot of money.
You betcha.
Somebody's going to, you know, the private sector and a lot of these things and big projects and all kinds of things is, I believe, going to be sort of really leaned on for solutions.
I wanted to ask you, do you think that Sarah Palin is finally done after losing Alaska?
Is Al Sharpton done?
No, wow.
No, I mean, I just don't. I think she's somebody who will always have a political base and always be a kingmaker.
The thing about Al Sharpton is that he delivers relief for his community. And when people don't have a lawyer and they've had something happen to them with law enforcement,
all right,
and then he shows up on the scene and comes to their rescue.
And now, Sarah Palin, you believe?
What does she provide? She operates, right. I think,
I do think she does, but I know. I mean, I was at a Sarah Palin rally in 2008, and for the people, you know, that like her, there is no like. You know, it's adoration. Okay. It's rock star. She's the real deal to them. She embodies a certain kind of, you know, conservative feminine ideal of, you know.
You know, if she's not the Al Sharpton of that side of the aisle, maybe she's like the Oprah, this person that you can just culturally identify with and sort of want to hear from, even if she doesn't deliver or show up, you know.
Something that's tangible.
Know, right. Like if Al Sharpton is showing up at your house because of a incident and you press conference and there's lawyers there, you know, that doesn't seem to be her MO. You know, she travels. There was a great piece by Jonathan Martin about how she has restrictions about when she shows up and then decides at the last minute to pull out and leaves candidates hanging. But if she does have this cultural connection with people, maybe she's more like,
well, what did you say in your scorecard, Ryan?
She did well numerically. We did a scorecard comparing Bloomberg and and Sarah Palin. They both did quite well, and they both also lost some significant races among the ones that they endorsed. I think Sarah Palin is a little bit tarnished by the major flame out off the chart, two out there, you know, Sharon Engel, Christine O'Donnell, Joe Miller, Carl Paladino Strain.
In your backyard.
But even in Alaska, but you know, I think the Al Sharpton analogy is a good one in that she is a politician without portfolio. She doesn't currently hold an office, and so she can go out there and be the person who represents Fox News, but who's not just a media person, who's actually in the political sector in the way that she is, without portfolio around the country. And so how much will she be a lightning rod for this particular feeling as time goes on and real leaders develop in Congress now that they have been elected? You know, I think time will tell. And I think that will have a lot to say about how much of a leadership role she maintains.
Yeah. Who took bigger risks in their endorsements between Palin and Bloomberg? Could you compare them?
I hadn't thought about it that way. There were different kinds of risks because Bloomberg – and I did notice, by the way, that out of scores of candidates that they each endorsed, there was zero overlap. They never endorsed the same. They endorsed against each other. You know, Bloomberg endorsed Harry Reid.
Right.
John Hickenlooper, right? Didn't he endorse Hickenlooper?
Hickenlooper, the governor of
right. –
Oh, no. Was it Bennett?
He
might have endorsed Hickenlooper.
Both,
yeah.
Actually. Both. You know, her endorsements were, in a way – people like she had been before she really got heavy into politics, although she had been a professional politician a long time. But the image is regular people coming in from the outside who were really going to be Tea Party. And some of those people were going to flame out. his risks are people who are very inside but who are very centrist and who don't appeal to the polarized bases of either party.
Right.
And, you know, are we going to be talking about either of them as presidential hopefuls when we reconvene digesting politics in 2012?
We didn't look at Christie's scorecard.
Well, much more serious than either of them. I didn't look at his scorecard.
Yeah, it was on It's a Free Country. He did worse than either one of them, I think.
but he's in there governing. He's in there. Look, Sarah Palin has a video out today. I haven't seen it, but it was described to me, where
sources say
that she is shown kayaking and doing something else.
Definitely going to be talking about her in 2012.
Outdoors and saying, isn't this better than sitting in some dingy government office? But what that means is she gave up the governorship to go be a rock star.
All right, so we need to point out that 2012 starts really – I mean, it really does start now because we're talking about – you know, some primaries that are going to be at the end of next year.
On your mark, get set, distort.
So who's going to be around? I mean, I think Sarah Palin's definitely in the discussion. Mitt Romney's definitely in the discussion, you know?
Do you think that there'll be a Democratic challenge? Do you think that Obama's safe from an internal party challenge?
I do.
Okay.
No, who challenges him? No one.
Who takes on the first African-American president within the Democratic Party? I don't see anyone doing that.
Unless he pulls Johnson and doesn't run, then I believe no one runs against him.
Oh, and the Green Party got on the ballot. That's one thing that happened. That's what I wanted to make sure.
Oh, that's the headline. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
My real headline.
Oh,
the real headline is Hope Turns to Nope.